dependencies, Terrazza said. How simple they can be, and how complex. Take, for example, tooth decay.
Tooth decay?
Teg was shocked off his Mentat track, and Odraid, observing this, saw that his reaction was precisely what Terrazza wanted. Terrazza was playing her Mentat Basha with a fine hand. And I am supposed to see this and learn from it, Odraid thought. Tooth decay, Terrazza repeated. A simple implant at birth prevents this bane for most of humankind. Still, we must brush the teeth and otherwise care for them. It is so natural to us that we seldom think about it. The devices we use are assumed to be wholly ordinary parts of our environment. Yet the devices, the materials in them, the instructors in tooth care and the souk monitors all have their interlocked relationships.
A Mentat does not need interdependencies explained to him, Teg said.
There was still curiosity in his voice, but with a definite undertone of resentment. Quite, Terrazza said. That is the natural environment of a Mentat's thinking process.
Then why do you belabor this?
Mentat, look at what you now know of these honored Matres and tell me, what is their flaw? Teg spoke without hesitation.
They can only survive if they continue to increase the dependency of those who support them. It's an addict's dead-end street.
Precisely. And the danger?
They could take much of humankind down with them.
That was the tyrant's problem, Miles. I'm sure he knew it. Now, pay attention to me with great care. And you too, Dar. Terrazza looked across the aisle and met Adraid's gaze. Both of you listen to me. We of the Bene Gesserit are setting very powerful elements adrift in the human current. They may jam up. They are sure to cause damage. And we... Once more, the lighter entered a period of severe buffeting. Conversation was impossible while they clung to their seats and listened to the roaring, creaking around them. When this interruption eased, Terrazza raised her voice. If we survive this damnable machine and get down to Gamu, you must go aside with Dar there, Miles. You have seen the Atreides manifesto. She will tell you about it and prepare you, that is all. Teg turned and looked at Odraid. Once more her features tugged at his memories, a remarkable likeness to Lucilla. But there was something else. He put this aside. The Atreides manifesto? He had read it because it came to him from Terrazza with instructions that he do so. Prepare me? For what? Odraid saw the questioning look on Teg's face. Now she understood Terrazza's motive. The Mother Superior's orders took on a new meaning, as did words from the manifesto itself. Just as the universe is created by the participation of consciousness, the prescient human carries that creative faculty to its ultimate extreme. This was the profoundly misunderstood power of the Atreides bastard, the power that he transmitted to his son, the tyrant. Odraid knew those words with an author's intimacy, but they came back to her now as though she had never before encountered them. Damn you, Tar, Odraid thought. What if you're wrong? At the quantum level, our universe can be seen as an indeterminate place, predictable in a statistical way only when you employ large enough numbers. Between that universe and a relatively predictable one where the passage of a single planet can be timed to a picosecond, other forces come into play. For the in-between universe where we find our daily lives, that which you believe is a dominant force. Your beliefs order the unfolding of daily events. If enough of us believe, a new thing can be made to exist. Belief structure creates a filter through which chaos is sifted into order. Analysis of the Tyrant, the Terrazza File, BG Archives. Teg's thoughts were in turmoil as he returned to Gamu from the guild ship. He stepped from the lighter at the black, charred edge of the keep's private landing field and looked around him as though for the first time. Almost noon. So little time had passed and so much had changed. To what extent would the Bene Gesserit go in imparting an essential lesson, he wondered. Terrazza had dislodged him from his familiar Mentat processes. He felt that the whole incident on the guild ship had been staged just for him. He had been shaken from a predictable course. How strange Gamo appeared as he crossed the guarded strip to the entry pits. Teg had seen many planets, learned their ways and how they printed themselves on their inhabitants. Some planets had a big yellow sun that sat in close and kept living things warm, evolving, growing. Some planets had little shimmer suns that hung far away in a dark sky, and their light touched very little. Variations existed within and even outside this range. Gamu was a yellow-green variation with a day of 31.27 standard hours and a 2.6 SY. Teg had thought he knew Gamu. When the Harkonnens were forced to abandon it, colonists left behind by the scattering came from the Danian group, calling it by the Halic name given to it in the Great Remapping. The colonists had been known as Caladanian in those days, but millennia tended to shorten some labels. Teg paused the entryway to the protective revetments that led from the field down beneath the keep. Terraza and her party lagged behind him. He saw Terraza was talking intently to Odraid.
Atreides Manifesto, he thought.
Even on Gamu, few admitted to either Harkonnen or Atreides ancestry, although the genotypes were visible here, especially the dominant Atreides, those long, sharp noses, the high foreheads and sensual mouths. Often the pieces were scattered, the mouth on one face, those piercing eyes on another, and countless mixtures. Sometimes, though, one person carried it all, and then you saw the pride, that inner knowledge, I am one of them. Gamu's natives recognized it and gave it walkway room, but few labeled it. Underlying all of this was what the Harkonnens had left behind, genetic lines tracing far away into the dawn times of Greek and Pathan and Mameluk, shadows of ancient history that few outside of professional historians or those trained by the Bene Gesserit could even name. Terraza and her party caught up with Teg. He heard her say to Odraid, "You must tell Miles all of it." Very well, she would tell him, he thought. He turned and led the way past the inner guards to the long passage under the pillboxes, into the keep proper.
Damn the Bene Gesserit, he thought. What were they really doing here on Gamu?
Plenty of Bene Gesserit signs could be seen on this planet. The back breeding to fix selected traits, and here and there a visible emphasis on seductive eyes for women. Teg returned a guard captain's salute without changing focus.
Seductive eyes. Yes.
He had seen this soon after his arrival at the Gola's Keep, and especially during his first inspection tour of the planet. He had seen himself in many faces, too, and recalled the thing old Patrin had mentioned so many times.
You have the Gamu look, Basha.
Seductive eyes. That guard captain back there had them. She and Odraid and Lucilla were alike in this. Few people paid much attention to the importance of eyes when it came to seduction, he thought. It took a Bene Gesserit upbringing to make that point. Big breasts in a woman and hard loins in a man, that tightly muscular look to the buttocks, these were naturally important in sexual matchings, but without the eyes, the rest of it could go for nothing. Eyes were essential. You could drown in the right kind of eyes, he had learned. Sink right into them and be unaware of what was being done to you until penis was firmly clasped in vagina. He had noted Lucilla's eyes immediately after his arrival on Gamu, and had walked cautiously. No doubts about how the sisterhood used her talents. There was Lucilla now, waiting at the central inspection and decontamination chamber. She gave him the flickering hand sign that all was well with the Gola. Teg relaxed and watched as Lucilla and Odraid confronted each other. The two women had remarkably similar features despite the age difference. Their bodies were quite different, though. Lucilla more solid against Odraid's willowy form. The guard captain of the seductive eyes came up beside Teg and leaned close to him. "Shuang Yu has just learned who you brought back with you," she said, nodding toward Terraza. "Ah, there she is now." Shuang Yu stepped from a lift tube and crossed to Terraza, giving only an angry glare to Teg.
Terraza wanted to surprise you, he thought. We all know why.
You don't appear happy to see me, Terraza said, addressing Shuang Yu.
I am surprised, Mother Superior, Shuang Yu said. I had no idea.
She glanced once more at Teg, a look of venom in her eyes. Odraid and Lucilla broke off their mutual examination.
I had heard about it, of course, Odraid said, but it is a stopper to confront yourself in the face of another person.
I warned you, Terrasa said. What are your orders, Mother Superior?
Shuang Yu asked. It was as close as she could come to asking the purpose of Terrasa's visit.
I would like a private word with Lucilla, Terrasa said.
I'll have quarters prepared for you, Shuang Yu said.
Don't bother, Terrasa said. I'm not staying. Miles has already arranged for my transport. Duty requires my presence at Chapter House. Lucilla and I will talk outside in the courtyard.
Terrasa put a finger to her cheek.
Oh, and I'd like to watch the Gola unobserved for a few minutes. I'm sure Lucilla can arrange it.
He's taking the more intense training quite well, Lucilla said as the two moved off toward a lift tube.
Teg turned his attention to Odraid, noting as his gaze passed across Shuang Yu's face the intensity of her anger. She was not trying to conceal it.
Was Lucilla a sister or a daughter of Odraid? Teg wondered.
It occurred to him suddenly that there must be a Bene Gesserit purpose behind the resemblance.
Yes, of course. Lucilla was an imprinter.
Shuang Yu overcame her anger. She looked with curiosity at Odraid.
I was just about to take lunch, sister, Shuang Yu said. Would you care to join me?
I must have a word alone with the Basha, Odraid said. If it is all right, perhaps we could remain here for our talk. I must not be seen by the Gola.
Shuang Yu scowled, not trying to hide her upset from Odraid. They knew at Chapter House where loyalties lay. But no one would remove her from this post of observational command. Opposition had its rights. Her thoughts were clear even to Teg. He noted the stiffness of Shuang Yu's back as she left them.
It is bad when sister is turned against sister, Odraid said.
Teg gave a hand sign to his guard captain, ordering her to clear the area.
Alone, Odraid said. Alone it would be.
To Odraid he said,
This is one of my areas. No spies or other means of observing us here.
I thought as much, Odraid said.
We have a service room over there,
Teg nodded to his left.
Furniture? Even chair dogs, if you prefer.
I hate it when they try to cuddle me, she said. Could we talk here?
She put a hand under Teg's arm.
Perhaps we could walk a bit. I got so stiff sitting in that lighter.
What is it you're supposed to tell me?
He asked as they strolled.
My memories are no longer selectively filtered, she said. I have them all, only on the female side, naturally.
So?
Teg pursed his lips. This was not the overture he had expected. Odraid appeared more like one who would take off on a direct approach.
Terrasa says you have read the Atreides Manifesto. Good. You know it will cause upset in many quarters.
Shuang Yu already has made it the subject of a diatribe against you, Atreides.
Odraid stared at him solemnly. As the reports all said, Teg remained an imposing figure. But she had known that without the reports.
We are both Atreides, you and I, Odraid said.
Teg came to full alert.
Your mother explained that to you in detail, Odraid said. When you took your first school leave back to Linnaeus.
Teg stopped and stared down at her.
How could she know this?
To his knowledge, he had never before met and conversed with this remote Darwi Odraid. Was he the subject of special discussions at Chapter House? He held his silence, forcing her to carry the conversation.
I will recount a conversation between a man and my birth mother, Odraid said. They are in bed, and the man says, I fathered a few children when I first escaped from the close bondage of the Bene Gesserit, back when I thought myself an independent agent, free to enlist and fight anywhere I chose.
Teg did not try to conceal his surprise. Those were his own words. Mentat memory told him O'Draid had them down as accurately as a mechanical recorder, even the tone. More? She asked, as he continued to stare at her. Very well. The man says, that was before they sent me to Mentat training, of course. What an eye-opener that was. I had never been out of the Sisterhood's sight for an instant. I was never a free agent.
Not even when I spoke those words,
Teg said. True. She urged him by pressure on his arm as they continued their stroll across the chamber. The children you fathered all belonged to the Bene Gesserit. The Sisterhood takes no chances that our genotype will be sent into the wild gene pool.
Let my body go to Shaitan. Their precious genotype remains in Sisterhood care, he said.
My care, O'Draid said. I am one of your daughters.
Again he forced her to stop.
I think you know who my mother was, she said.
She held up a hand for silence as he started to respond.
Names are not necessary.
Teg studied O'Draid's features, seeing the recognizable signs there. Mother and daughter were matched.
But what of Lucilla?
As though she heard his question, O'Draid said, Lucilla is from a parallel breeding line. Quite remarkable, isn't it, what careful breed matching can achieve? Teg cleared his throat. He felt no emotional attachment to this newly revealed daughter. Her words and other important signals of her performance demanded his primary attention.
There is no casual conversation, he said. Is this all of what you were to reveal to me? I thought the Mother Superior said—
There is more, O'Draid agreed. The Manifesto. I am its author. I wrote it at Terraza's orders and followed her detailed instructions.
Teg glanced around the large chamber as though to make sure no one overheard. He spoke in a lowered voice.
The Telelaxu are spreading it far and wide.
Just as we hoped.
Why are you telling me this? Terraza said you were to prepare me for—
There will come a time when you must know our purpose. It is Terraza's wish that you make your own decisions then, that you really become a free agent.
Even as she spoke, O'Draid saw the Mentat glaze in his eyes. Teg breathed deeply.
Dependences and keylogs.
He felt the Mentat sense of an enormous pattern just beyond the reach of his accumulated data. He did not even consider for an instant that some form of filial devotion had prompted these revelations. There was a fundamentalist, dogmatic, and ritualistic essence apparent in all Bene Gesserit training, despite every effort to prevent this. O'Draid, this daughter out of his past, was a full reverend mother with extraordinary powers of muscle and nerve control, full memories on the female side. She was one of the special ones. She knew tricks of violence that few humans ever suspected. Still, that similarity, that essence, remained, and a Mentat always saw it.
What does she want? Affirmation of his paternity?
She already had all of the confirmation she could need. Observing her now, the way she waited so patiently for his thoughts to resolve, Teg reflected that it often was said with truth that reverend mothers no longer were completely members of the human race. They moved somehow outside the main flow, perhaps parallel to it, perhaps diving into it occasionally for their own purposes, but always removed from humankind. They removed themselves. It was an identifying mark of the Reverend Mother, a sense of extra identity that made them closer to the long-dead tyrant than to the human stock from which they sprang. Manipulation, that was their mark. They manipulated everyone and everything.
I am to be the Bene Gesserit's eyes, Teg said. Terraza wants me to make a human decision for all of you.
Obviously pleased, O'Draid squeezed his arm.
What a father I have.
Do you really have a father?
He asked, and he recounted for her what he had been thinking about the Bene Gesserit removing themselves from humanity.
Outside humanity, she said. What a curious idea. Are guild navigators also outside their original humanity?
He thought about this. Guild navigators diverged widely from humankind's more common shape. Born in space and living out their lives in tanks of mélange gas, they distorted the original form, elongated and repositioned limbs and organs. But a young navigator in Estrus, and before entering the tank, could breed with a norm. It had been demonstrated. They became non-human, but not in the way of the Bene Gesserit.
"Navigators are not your mental kin," he said. "They think human. Guiding a ship through space, even with prescience to find the safe way, has a pattern a human can accept."
"You don't accept our pattern?"
"As far as I can. But somewhere in your development you shift outside the original pattern. I think you may perform a conscious act even to appear human. This way you hold my arm right now, as though you really were my daughter."
"I am your daughter, but I'm surprised you think so little of us."
"Quite the contrary. I stand in awe of you."
"Of your own daughter?"
"Of any reverend mother."
"You think I exist only to manipulate lesser creatures?"
"I think you no longer really feel human. There's a gap in you, something missing, something you've removed. You no longer are one of us."
"Thank you," O'Grade said. "Terraza told me you would not hesitate to answer truthfully, but I knew that for myself."
"For what have you prepared me?"
"You will know it when it occurs. That is all I can say, all I am permitted to say."
"Manipulating again," he thought. "Damn them."
O'Grade cleared her throat. She appeared about to say something more, but she remained silent as she guided Teg around and strolled with him back across the chamber. Even though she had known what Teg must say, his words pained her. She wanted to tell him that she was one of those who still felt human, but his judgment of the sisterhood could not be denied. "We are taught to reject love. We can simulate it, but each of us is capable of cutting it off in an instant." There were sounds behind them. They stopped and turned. Lucilla and Terraza emerged from a lift tube, speaking idly about their observations of the Gola.
"You are absolutely right to treat him as one of us," Terraza said.
Teg heard but made no comment as they awaited the approach of the two women.
"He knows," O'Grade thought. "He will not ask me about my birth mother. There was no bonding, no real imprint. Yes, he knows."
O'Grade closed her eyes, and memory startled her by producing of itself an image of a painting. The thing occupied a space on the wall of Terraza's morning room. Ixion artifice had preserved the painting in the finest hermetically sealed frame behind a cover of invisible plaz. O'Grade often stopped in front of the painting, feeling each time that her hand might reach out and actually touch the ancient canvas so cunningly preserved by the Ixions. Cottages at Caldeville. The artist's name for his work and his own name were preserved on a burnished plate beneath the painting. Vincent van Gogh. The thing dated from a time so ancient that only rare remnants such as this painting remained to send a physical impression down the ages. She had tried to imagine the journeys that painting had taken, the serial chance that had brought it intact to Terraza's room. The Ixions had been at their best in the preservation and restoration. An observer could touch a dark spot on the lower left corner of the frame. Immediately, you were engulfed in the true genius, not only of the artist, but of the Ixion who had restored and preserved the work. His name was there on the frame. Martin Buro. When touched by the human finger, the dot became a sense projector, a benign spin-off of the technology that had produced the Ixion probe. Buro had restored not only the painting, but the painter, Van Gogh's feeling, accompaniment to each brush stroke. All had been captured in the brush strokes, recorded there by human movements. O'Grade had stood there, engrossed through the whole performance so many times, she felt she could recreate the painting independently. Recalling this experience so near to Teg's accusation, she knew at once why her memory had reproduced the image for her, why that painting still fascinated her. For the brief space of that replay, she always felt totally human, aware of the cottages as places where real people dwelled, aware in some complete way of the living chain that had paused there in the person of the mad Vincent van Gogh, paused to record itself. Terraza and Lucilla stopped about 2 paces from Teg and O'Grade. There was a smell of garlic on Teraza's breath.
We stopped for a small bite to eat, Teraza said. Would you like anything?
It was exactly the wrong question. Odraid freed her hand from Teg's arm. She turned quickly and wiped her eyes on her cuff. Looking up once more at Teg, she saw surprise on his face.
Yes, she thought. Those were real tears.
I think we've done everything here that we can, Teraza said. It's time you were on your way to Rakis, Dar.
Past time, Odraid said.
Life cannot find reasons to sustain it, cannot be a source of decent mutual regard, unless each of us resolves to breathe such qualities into it. Chenoa, Conversations with Leto II. Hedley Tuak, High Priest of the Divided God, had grown increasingly angry with Styros. Although too old himself ever to hope for the High Priest's bench, Styros had sons, grandsons, and numerous nephews. Styros had transferred his personal ambitions to his family. A cynical man, Styros. He'd represented a powerful faction in the priesthood, the so-called scientific community, whose influence was insidious and pervasive. They veered dangerously close to heresy. Tuak reminded himself that more than one high priest had been lost in the desert, regrettable accidents. Styros and his faction were capable of creating such an accident. It was afternoon in Keen, and Styros had just departed, obviously frustrated. Styros wanted Tuak to go into the desert and personally observe Shiana's next venture there. Suspicious of the invitation, Tuak declined. A strange argument ensued, full of innuendo and vague references to Shiana's behaviour, plus wordy attacks on the Bene Gesserit. Styros, always suspicious of the sisterhood, had taken an immediate dislike to the new commander of the Bene Gesserit keep on Rakis. What was her name? Oh yes, Odraid. Odd name, but then the sisters often took odd names. That was their privilege. God himself had never spoken against the basic goodness of the Bene Gesserit. Against individual sisters, yes, but the sisterhood itself had shared God's holy vision. Tuak did not like the way Styros spoke of Shiana. Cynical. Tuak had finally silenced Styros with pronouncements delivered here in the Sanctus with its high altar and images of the divided god. Prismatic beam relays cast thin wedges of brilliance through drifting incense from burning melange onto the double line of tall pillars that led up to the altar. Tuak knew his words went directly to God from this setting.
God works through our latter-day Siona, Tuak had told Styros, noting the confusion on the old counselor's face. Shiana is the living reminder of Siona, that human instrument who translated him into his present divisions.
Styros raged, saying things he would not dare repeat before the full council. He presumed too much on his long association with Tuak.
I tell you, she is sitting here surrounded by adults intent upon justifying themselves to her and—
And to God.
Tuak could not let such words pass. Leaning close to the high priest, Styros grated.
She is at the center of an educational system geared to anything her imagination demands. We deny her nothing.
Nor should we.
It was as though Tuak had not spoken. Styros said,
Kania has provided her with recordings from Dar es Balat.
I am the Book of Fate,
Tuak intoned, quoting God's own words from the hoard at Dar es Balat.
Exactly, and she listens to every word.
Why does this disturb you?
Tuak asked in his calmest tone.
We don't test her knowledge. She tests ours.
God must want it so.
Not mistaking the bitter anger on Styros's face, Tuak observed this and waited while the old counselor marshalled new arguments. Resources for such arguments were, of course, enormous. Tuak did not deny this. It was the interpretations that mattered, which was why a high priest must be the final interpreter. Despite, or perhaps because of, their way of viewing history, the priesthood knew a great deal of how God had come to reside on Rakis. They had Dar es Balat itself and all of its contents, the earliest known no-chamber in the universe. For millennia, while Shai Hulud translated the verdant planet of Arrakis into Desert Arrakis, Dar es Balat waited under the sands. From that holy hoard, the priesthood possessed God's own voice, his printed words, and even holophotos. Everything was explained, and they knew that the desert surface of Arrakis reproduced the original form of the planet, the way it looked in the beginning, when it was the only known source of the holy spice.
"She asks about God's family," Styros said. "Why should she have to ask about—" "She tests us. Do we give them their proper places? The Reverend Mother Jessica to her son, Muad'Dib, to his son, Leto the Second, the Holy Triumvirate of Heaven." "Leto the Third," Styros muttered. "What of the other Leto who died at Sardukar hands? What of him?"
"Careful, Styros," Tuek intoned. "You know my great-grandfather pronounced upon that question from this very bench. Our divided god was reincarnated with part of him remaining in heaven to mediate the ascendancy. That part of him became nameless then, as the true essence of God should always be."
"Oh?"
Tuek heard the terrible cynicism in the old man's voice. Styros's words seemed to tremble in the incense-laden air, inviting terrible retribution.
"Then why does she ask how our Leto was transformed into the divided god?" Styros demanded.
Did Styros question the holy metamorphosis? Tuek was aghast. He said,
"In time she will enlighten us."
"Our feeble explanations must fill her with dismay," Styros sneered.
"You go too far, Styros."
"Indeed? You do not think it enlightening that she asks how the sand trout encapsulate most of Arrakis's water and recreate the desert?"
Tuek tried to conceal his growing anger. Styros did represent a powerful faction in the priesthood, but his tone and his words raised questions that had been answered by high priests long ago. The metamorphosis of Leto the Second had given birth to uncounted sand trout, each carrying a bit of himself. Sand trout to divided God. The sequence was known and worshipped. To question this denied God.
"You sit here and do nothing," Styros accused. "We are pawns of—"
"Enough!"
Tuek had heard all he wanted to hear of this old man's cynicism. Drawing his dignity around him, Tuek spoke the words of God.
"Your lord knows very well what is in your heart. Your soul suffices this day as a reckoner against you. I need no witnesses. You do not listen to your soul, but listen instead to your anger and your rage."
Styros retired in frustration. After considerable thought, Tuek enrobed himself in his most suitable finery of white, gold, and purple. He went to visit Shiana. Shiana was in the roof garden atop the central priestly complex, there with Kania and two others, a young priest named Baldic, who was in Tuek's private service, and an acolyte princess named Kipuna, who behaved too much like a reverend mother for Tuek's liking. The sisterhood had its spies here, of course, but Tuek did not like to be aware of it. Kipuna had taken over much of Shiana's physical training, and there had grown a rapport between child and acolyte priestess that aroused Kania's jealousy. Even Kania, however, could not stand in the way of Shiana's commands. The four of them stood beside a stone bench, almost in the shadow of a ventilator tower. Kipuna held Shiana's right hand, manipulating the child's fingers. Shiana was growing tall, Tuek noted. 6 years she had been his charge. He could see the first beginnings of breasts poking out her robe. There was not a breath of wind on the rooftop, and the air felt heavy in Tuek's lungs. Tuek glanced around the garden to assure himself that his security arrangements were not being ignored. One never knew from what quarter danger might appear. Four of Tuek's own personal guards, well-armed but concealing it, shared the rooftop at a distance, one at each corner. The parapet enclosing the garden was a high one, just the guards' heads standing above the rim. The only building higher than this priestly tower was Keen's primary wind trap about 1,000 meters to the west. Despite the visible evidence that his security orders were being carried out, Tuek sensed danger. Was God warning him? Tuek still felt disturbed by Styros' cynicism. Was it wrong to allow Styros that much latitude? Shiana saw Tuek approaching and stopped the odd finger-flexing exercises she was performing at Kipuna's instructions. Giving every appearance of knowledgeable patience, the child stood silently with her gaze fixed on the high priest, forcing her companions to turn and watch with her. Shiana did not find Tuek a fearsome figure. She rather liked the old man, although some of his questions were so bumbling. And his answers. Quite by accident, she had discovered the question that most disturbed Tuek. Why? Some of the ancient priests interpreted her questions aloud as, "Why do you believe this?" Shiana immediately picked up on this, and thereafter her probings of Tuek and the others took the unvarying form, "Why do you believe this?" Tuek stopped about 2 paces from Shiana and bowed.
"Good afternoon, Shiana."
He twisted his neck nervously against the collar of his robe. The sun felt hot on his shoulders, and he wondered why the child chose to be out here so often. Shiana maintained her probing stare at Tuek. She knew this gaze disturbed him. Tuek cleared his throat. When Shiana looked at him that way, he always wondered, "Is it God looking at me through her eyes?" Kania spoke.
"Shiana has been asking today about the fish speakers."
In his most unctuous tones, Tuek said,
"God's own holy army."
"All of them women?"
Shiana asked. She spoke as though she could not believe it. To those at the base of Rakian society, fish speakers were a name from ancient history, people cast out in the famine times. "She is testing me," Tuek thought. Fish speakers. The modern carriers of the name had only a small, trading spying delegation on Rakis composed of both men and women. Their ancient origins no longer were significant to their current activities, mostly working as an arm of Ix.
"Men always served the fish speakers in an advisory capacity," Tuek said.
He watched carefully to see how Shiana would respond.
"Then there were always the Duncan Idahos," Kania said.
"Yes, yes, of course, the Duncans,"
Tuek tried not to scowl. That woman was always interrupting. Tuek did not like being reminded of this aspect to God's historical presence on Rakis. The recurrent Gola and his position in the Holy Army carried overtones of Bene Tlelak's indulgence. But there was no avoiding the fact that fish speakers had guarded the Duncans from harm, acting, of course, at the behest of God. The Duncans were holy, no doubt of it, but in a special category. By God's own account, he had killed some of the Duncans himself, obviously translating them immediately into heaven.
"Kipuna has been telling me about the Bene Gesserit," Shiana said.
How the child's mind darted around. Tuek cleared his throat, recognizing his own ambivalent attitude toward the Reverend Mothers. Reverence was demanded for those who were beloved of God, such as the saintly Chenua, and the first high priest had constructed a logical account of how the holy Hui Nori, bride of God, had been a secret Reverend Mother. Honoring these special circumstances, the priesthood felt an irritating responsibility toward the Bene Gesserit, which was carried out chiefly by selling melange to the sisterhood at a price ridiculously below that charged by the Tlelaxu. In her most ingenuous tones, Shiana said,
"Tell me about the Bene Gesserit, Headley."
Tuek glanced sharply at the adults around Shiana, trying to catch a smile on their faces. He did not know how to deal with Shiana calling him by his first name that way. In one sense, it was demeaning. In another sense, she honored him by such intimacy.
"God tests me sorely," he thought.
"Are the Reverend Mothers good people?"
Shiana asked. Tuek sighed. The records all confirmed that God harbored reservations about the sisterhood. God's words had been examined carefully and submitted finally to a high priest's interpretation. God did not let the sisterhood threaten his golden path. That much was clear.
"Many of them are good,"
Tuek said.
"Where is the nearest Reverend Mother?"
Shiana asked.
"At the sisterhood's embassy here in Keene,"
Tuek said.
"Do you know her?"
There are many reverend mothers in the Bene Gesserit keep, he said.
What's a keep?
That's what they call their home here.
One reverend mother must be in charge. Do you know that one?
I knew her predecessor, Tamerlane, but this one is new. She has only just arrived. Her name is Audrade.
That's a funny name.
Tuek's own thought. But he said,
one of our historians tells me it is a form of the name Atreides.
Shiana reflected upon this. Atreides. That was the family that had brought Shaitan into being. Before the Atreides, there had been only the Fremen and Shai-Hulud. The oral history which her people preserved against all priestly prohibition chanted the begats of the most important people on Rakis. Shiana had heard these names many nights in her village.
Wad Dib begat the tyrant. The tyrant begat Shaitan.
Shiana did not feel like arguing truth with Tuek. Anyway, he looked tired today. She said merely,
bring me this, Reverend Mother Audrade.
Kipuna hid a gloating smile behind her hand. Tuek stepped back, aghast. How could he comply with such a demand? Even the Rakian priesthood did not command the Bene Gesserit. What if the sisterhood refused him? Could he offer a gift of melange in exchange? That might be a sign of weakness. The Reverend Mothers might bargain. No harder bargainers lived than the sisterhood's cold-eyed Reverend Mothers. This new one, this Audrade, looked to be one of the worst. All of these thoughts fled through Tuek's mind in an instant. Kania intruded, giving Tuek the needed approach.
Perhaps Kipuna could convey Shiana's invitation, Kania said.
Tuek darted a glance at the young acolyte priestess.
Yes.
Many suspected, Kania among them, obviously, that Kipuna spied for the Bene Gesserit. Of course, everyone on Rakis spied for someone. Tuek put on his most gracious smile as he nodded to Kipuna.
Do you know any of the Reverend Mothers, Kipuna?
Some of them are known to me, my Lord High Priest, Kipuna said.
At least she still shows the proper deference.
Excellent, Tuek said. Would you be so kind as to start this gracious invitation from Shiana moving up through the Sisterhood's embassy?
I will do my poor best, my Lord High Priest.
I'm sure you will.
Kipuna began a prideful turn toward Shiana, the knowledge of success growing within her. Shiana's request had been ridiculously easy to ignite, given the techniques provided by the Sisterhood. Kipuna smiled and opened her mouth to speak. A movement at the parapet, about 40 meters behind Shiana, caught Kipuna's attention. Something glinted in the sunlight there, something small and... With a strangled cry, Kipuna grabbed up Shiana, hurled her at the startled Tuek and shouted, Run! With that, Kipuna dashed toward the swiftly advancing brightness, a tiny seeker trailing a long length of sugar wire. In his younger days, Tuek had played bat ball. He caught Shiana instinctively, hesitated for an instant, and then recognized the danger. Whirling with a squirming, protesting girl in his arms, Tuek dashed through the open door of the stair tower. He heard the door slam behind him and Kania's rapid footsteps close on his heels.
What is it? What is it?
Shiana pounded her fists against Tuek's chest as she shouted.
Hush, Shiana! Hush!
Tuek paused on the first landing. Both a chute and suspensor drop led from this landing into the building's core. Kania stopped beside Tuek, her panting loud in the narrow space.
It killed Kipuna and two of your gods, Kania gasped. Cut them up, I saw it. God preserve us.
Tuek's mind was a maelstrom. Both the chute and the suspensor drop system were enclosed wormholes through the tower. They could be sabotaged. The attack on the roof might be only one element in a far more complex plot.
Put me down, Shiana insisted. What's happening?
Tuek eased her to the floor but kept one of her hands clutched in his hand.
He bent over her. Shiana, dear, someone is trying to harm us.
Shiana's mouth formed a silent O, then,
They hurt Kipuna?
Tuek looked up at the roof door. Was that an ornithopter he heard up there?
Styros.
Conspirators could take 3 vulnerable people into the desert so easily. Kania had regained her breath.
I hear a thopter, she said.
Shouldn't we be getting away from here?
We will go down by the stairs,
Tuek said.
But the...
Do as I say!
Keeping a firm hand on Shiana's hand, Tuek led the way down to the next landing. In addition to the chute and suspensor access, this landing had a door into a wide, curving hall. Only a few short steps beyond the door lay the entrance to Shiana's quarters, once Tuek's own quarters. Again he hesitated.
Something's happening on the roof,
Kania whispered. Tuek looked down at the fearfully silent child beside him. Her hand felt sweaty. Yes, there was some sort of uproar on the roof, shouts, the hiss of burners, much running about. The roof door, now out of sight above them, crashed open. This decided Tuek. He flung open the door into the hallway and dashed out into the arms of a tightly grouped wedge of black-robed women. With an empty sense of defeat, Tuek recognized the woman at the point of the wedge. Audraid. Someone plucked Shiana away from him and hustled her back into the press of robed figures. Before Tuek or Kania could protest, hands were clapped over their mouths. Other hands pinioned them against a wall on the hallway. Some of the robed figures went through the doorway and up the stairs.
The child is safe, and that's all that's important for the moment, Audraid whispered.
She looked into Tuek's eyes.
Make no outcry.
The hand was removed from his mouth. Using voice, she said,
Tell me about the roof.
Tuek found himself complying without reservation.
A seeker towing a long shiger wire. It came over the parapet. Kipuna saw it and...
Where is Kipuna?
Dead. Kania saw it.
Tuek described Kipuna's brave dash toward the threat.
Kipuna dead,
Audraid thought. She concealed a fiercely angry sense of loss. What a waste. There must be admiration for such a brave death. But the loss. The sisterhood always needed such courage and devotion, but it also required the genetic wealth Kipuna had represented. It was gone. Taken by these stumbling fools. At a gesture from Audraid, the hand was removed from Kania's mouth.
Tell me what you saw, Audraid said.
The seeker whipped the shiger wire around Kipuna's neck and...
Kania shuddered. The dull thump of an explosion reverberated above them, then silence. Audraid waved a hand. Robed women spread along the hallway, moving silently out of sight beyond the curve. Only Audraid and two others, both chill-eyed younger women with intense expressions, remained beside Tuek and Kania. Shiana was nowhere to be seen.
The Ixians are in this somewhere, Audraid said.
Tuek agreed.
That much shiger wire.
Where have you taken the child?
He asked.
We are protecting her, Audraid said. Be still.
She tipped her head, listening. A robed woman sped back around the curve of the hallway and whispered something in Audraid's ear. Audraid produced a tight smile.
It is over, Audraid said. We will go to Shiana.
Shiana occupied a softly cushioned blue chair in the main room of her quarters. Black-robed women stood in a protective arc behind her. The child appeared to have quite recovered from the shock of the attack and escape, but her eyes glittered with excitement and unasked questions. Shiana's attention was directed at something off to Tuek's right. He stopped and looked there, gasping at what he saw. A naked male body lay against the wall in an oddly crumpled position, the head twisted until the chin lay back over the left shoulder. Open eyes stared out with the emptiness of death. Styros. The shredded rags of Styros's robe, obviously torn from him violently, lay in an untidy heap near the body's feet. Tuek looked at Audraid.
He was in on it, she said. There were face dancers with the Ixians.
Tuek tried to swallow in a dry throat. Kania shuffled past him toward the body. Tuek could not see her face, but Kania's presence reminded him that there had been something between Styros and Kania in their younger days. Tuek moved instinctively to place himself between Kania and the seated child. Kania stopped at the body and nudged it with a foot. She turned a gloating expression on Tuek.
I had to make sure he was really dead, she said.
Audraid glanced at a companion.
Get rid of the body.
She looked at Shiana. It was O'Drade's first chance for a more careful study of the child since leading the assault force here to deal with the attack on the temple complex. Tuek spoke behind O'Drade.
Reverend Mother, could you explain, please, what...
O'Drade interrupted without turning.
Later.
Shiana's expression quickened at Tuek's words.
I thought you were a Reverend Mother.
O'Drade merely nodded. What a fascinating child. O'Drade experienced the sensations she felt while standing in front of the ancient painting in Taraza's quarters. Some of the fire that had gone into the work of art inspired O'Drade now. Wild inspiration. That was the message from the Mad Van Gogh. Chaos brought into magnificent order. Was that not part of the Sisterhood's coda? This child is my canvas, O'Drade thought. She felt her hand tingle to the feeling of that ancient brush. Her nostrils flared to the smells of oils and pigments.
Leave me alone with Shiana, O'Drade ordered. Everybody out.
Tuek started to protest, but stopped when one of O'Drade's robed companions gripped his arm. O'Drade glared at him.
The Bene Gesserit have served you before, she said. This time, we saved your life.
The woman holding Tuek's arm tugged at him.
Answer his questions, O'Drade said, but do it somewhere else.
Khanhir took a step toward Shiana.
That child is my...
Leave,
O'Drade barked, all the powers of voice in the command. Khanhir froze.
You almost lost her to a bumbling lot of conspirators, O'Drade said, glaring at Khanhir. We will consider whether you get any further opportunity to associate with Shiana.
Tears started in Khanhir's eyes, but O'Drade's condemnation could not be denied. Turning, Khanhir fled with the others. O'Drade returned her attention to the watchful child.
We've been a long time waiting for you, O'Drade said. We will not give those fools another opportunity to lose you.
Law always chooses sides on the basis of enforcement power. Morality and legal niceties have little to do with it when the real question is, who has the clout? Bene Gesserit Council Proceedings. Archives number XOX232. Immediately after Taraza and her party left Gamu, Teg threw himself into his work. New innkeep procedures had to be laid out, holding Shuangyu at arm's length from the Gola, Taraza's orders. She can observe all she wants. She can't touch. In spite of the work pressures, Teg found himself staring into space at odd moments, prey to free-floating anxiety. The experience of rescuing Taraza's party from the guild ship and O'Drade's odd revelations did not fit into any data classification he constructed. Dependencies. Key logs. Teg found himself seated in his own workroom, an assignment schedule projected in front of him with shift changes to approve, and for a moment he had no idea of the time or even the date. It took a moment to relocate himself. Mid-morning. Taraza and her party had been gone 2 days. He was alone. Yes, Patrin had taken over this day's training schedule with Duncan, freeing Teg for the command decisions. The workroom around Teg felt alien, yet when he looked at each element in it, he found each thing familiar. Here was his own personal data console. His uniform jacket had been draped neatly across a chair back beside him. He tried to fall into Mentat mode and found his own mind resisting. He had not encountered that phenomenon since training days. Training days. Taraza and O'Drade between them had thrown him back into some form of training. Self-training. In a detached way, he felt his memory offering up a long-ago conversation with Taraza. How familiar it was. He was right there, caught in the moments of his own memory snare. Both he and Taraza had been quite tired after making the decisions and taking the actions to prevent a bloody confrontation, the Barundiko incident. Nothing but a hiccup in history now, but at the time it had demanded all of their combined energies. Taraza invited him into the small parlour of her quarters on her no-ship after the agreement was signed. She spoke casually, admiring his sagacity, the way he had seen through to the weaknesses that would force a compromise. They had been awake and active for almost 30 hours, and Teg was glad for the opportunity to sit while Taraza dialed her food drink installation. It dutifully produced two tall glasses of creamy, brown liquid. Teg recognized the smell as she handed him his glass. It was a quick source of energy, a pick-me-up that the Bene Gesserit seldom shared with outsiders. But Terrazza no longer considered him an outsider. His head tipped back. Teg took a long swallow of the drink, his gaze on the ornate ceiling of Terrazza's small parlour. This no-ship was an old-fashioned model, built in the days when more care had been taken with decoration, heavily incised cornices, baroque figures carved in every surface. The taste of the drink pushed his memory back into childhood, the heavy infusion of melange.
"My mother made this for me whenever I was overly strenuous," he said, looking at the glass in his hand.
He already could feel the calming energy flow through his body. Terrazza took her own drink to a chair dog opposite him, a fluffy white bit of animate furniture that fitted itself to her with the ease of long familiarity. For Teg, she had provided a traditional green upholstered chair, but she saw his glance flick across the chair dog and grinned at him. "Tastes differ, Miles." She sipped her drink and sighed. "My, that was strenuous, but it was good work. There were moments when it was right on the edge of getting very nasty." Teg found himself touched by her relaxation. No pose, no ready-made mask to set them apart and define their separate roles in the Bene Gesserit hierarchy. She was being obviously friendly and not even a hint of seductiveness. So this was just what it seemed to be, as much as that could be said about any encounter with a Reverend Mother. With quick elation, Teg realized that he had become quite adept at reading Alma Mavis Terrazza, even when she adopted one of her masks. "Your mother taught you more than she was told to teach you," Terrazza said. "A wise woman but another heretic. That's all we seem to be breeding nowadays."
"Heretic?"
He was caught by resentment. "That's a private joke in the sisterhood," Terrazza said. "We are supposed to follow a Mother Superior's orders with absolute devotion. And we do. Except when we disagree." Teg smiled and took a deep draught of his drink. "It's odd," Terrazza said, "but while we were in that tight little confrontation, I found myself reacting to you as I would to one of my sisters." Teg felt the drink warming his stomach. It left a tingling in his nostrils. He placed the empty glass on a side table and spoke while looking at it.
"My eldest daughter."
"That would be Demela. You should have let us have her, Miles."
"It was not my decision."
"But one word from you," Terrazza shrugged. "Well, that's past. What about Demela?"
"She thinks I'm often too much like one of you."
"Too much?"
"She is fiercely loyal to me, Mother Superior. She doesn't really understand our relationship, and..."
"What is our relationship?"
"You command, and I obey."
Terrazza looked at him over the lip of her glass. When she put down the glass, she said, "Yes, you've never really been a heretic, Miles. Perhaps, someday." He spoke quickly, wanting to divert Terrazza from such ideas.
"Demela thinks the long use of melange makes many people become like you."
"Is that so? Isn't it odd, Miles, that a geriatric potion should have so many side effects?"
"I don't find that odd."
"No, of course you wouldn't." She drained her glass and put it aside. "I was addressing the way a significant life extension has produced in some people, you especially, a profound knowledge of human nature."
"We live longer and observe more," he said.
"I don't think it's quite that simple. Some people never observe anything. Life just happens to them. They get by on little more than a kind of dumb persistence, and they resist with anger and resentment anything that might lift them out of that false serenity."
"I've never been able to strike an acceptable balance sheet for the spice," he said,
referring to a common Mentat process of data sorting. Terrazza nodded. Obviously, she found the same difficulty. "We of the Sisterhood tend to be more single-track than Mentats," she said. "We have routines to shake ourselves out of it, but the condition persists."
"Our ancestors have had this problem for a long time," he said.
"But it was different before the spice," she said.
"But they lived such short lives."
50, 100 years? That doesn't seem very long to us, but still.
"Did they compress more into the available time?"
"Oh, they were frenetic at times." She was giving him observations from her other memories, he realized. Not the first time he had shared in such ancient lore. His mother had produced such memories on occasion, but always as a lesson. Was Terrasa doing that now? Teaching him something? "Mélange is a many-handed monster," she said.
"Do you sometimes wish we had never found it?"
"The Bene Gesserit would not exist without it."
"Nor the Guild."
"But there would have been no tyrant, no Muad'Dib. The spice gives with one hand and takes with all of its others."
"Which hand contains that which we desire?"
he asked.
"Isn't that always the question?"
"You're an oddity, you know that, Miles? Mentats so seldom dip into philosophy. I think it's one of your strengths. You are supremely able to doubt." He shrugged. This turn in the conversation disturbed him. "You are not amused," she said. "But cling to your doubts anyway. Doubt is necessary to a philosopher."
"So the Zensuni assure us?"
"All mystics agree on it, Miles. Never underestimate the power of doubts. Very persuasive. Satori holds up doubt and surety in a single hand." Really quite surprised, he asked,
"Do Reverend Mothers practice Zensuni rituals?"
He had never even suspected this before.
"Just once," she said. "We achieve an exalted form of Satori, total. It involves every cell."
"The spice agony," he said.
"I was sure your mother told you. Obviously she never explained the affinity with the Zensuni."
Teg swallowed past a lump in his throat. Fascinating. She gave him a new insight into the Bene Gesserit. This changed his entire concept, including his image of his own mother. They were removed from him into an unattainable place where he could never follow. They might think of him as a comrade on occasion, but he could never enter the intimate circle. He could simulate, no more. He would never be like Muad'Dib or the tyrant.
"Prescience,"
Terrasa said. The word shifted his attention. She had changed the subject, but not changed it.
"I was thinking about Muad'Dib," he said.
"You think he predicted the future," she said.
"That is the Mentat teaching."
"I hear the doubt in your voice, Miles. Did he predict, or did he create? Prescience can be deadly. The people who demand that the oracle predict for them really want to know next year's price on whale fur, or something equally mundane. None of them wants an instant-by-instant prediction of his personal life."
"No surprises," Teg said.
"Exactly. If you possessed such foreknowledge, your life would become an unutterable bore."
"You think Muad'Dib's life was a bore?"
"And the tyrants, too. We think their entire lives were devoted to trying to break out of chains they themselves created."
"But they believed..."
"Remember your philosopher's doubts, Miles. Beware. The mind of the believer stagnates. It fails to grow outward into an unlimited, infinite universe."
Teg sat silently for a moment. He sensed the fatigue that had been driven beyond his immediate awareness by the drink, sensed also the way his thoughts were roiled by the intrusion of new concepts. These were things that he had been taught would weaken a Mentat, yet he felt strengthened by them.
"She is teaching me," he thought. "There is a lesson here."
As though projected into his mind and outlined there in fire, he found his entire Mentat attention fixated on the Zensuni admonition that was taught to every beginning student in the Mentat school. "By your belief in granular singularities, you deny all movement, evolutionary or devolutionary. Belief fixes a granular universe and causes that universe to persist. Nothing can be allowed to change because that way your non-moving universe vanishes. But it moves of itself when you do not move. It evolves beyond you and is no longer accessible to you." "The oddest thing of all," Terrasa said, sinking into tune with this mood she had created, "is that the scientists of Ix cannot see how much their own beliefs dominate their universe." Teg stared at her, silent and receptive. "Ixian beliefs are perfectly submissive to the choices they make on how they will look at their universe," Terrasa said. "Their universe does not act of itself, but performs according to the kinds of experiments they choose." With a start, Teg came out of the memories and awoke to find himself in the Gamu Keep. He still sat in the familiar chair in his workroom. A glance around the room showed nothing moved from where he had put it. Only a few minutes had passed, but the room and its contents no longer were alien. He dipped into and out of Mentat mode. Restored. The smell and taste of the drink Terraza had given him so long ago still tingled on his tongue and in his nostrils. A Mentat blink, and he knew he could call up the scene entire once more. The low light of shaded glow globes, the feeling of the chair beneath him, the sounds of their voices. It was all there for replay, frozen into a time capsule of isolated memory. Calling up that old memory created a magical universe where his abilities were amplified beyond his wildest expectations. No atoms existed in that magical universe, only waves and awesome movements all around. He was forced there to discard all barriers built of belief and understanding. This universe was transparent. He could see through it without any interfering screens upon which to project its forms. The magical universe reduced him to a core of active imagination where his own image-making abilities were the only screen upon which any projection might be sensed.
There, I am both the performer and the performed.
The workroom around Teg wavered into and out of his sensory reality. He felt his awareness constricted to its tightest purpose, and yet that purpose filled his universe. He was open to infinity.
Terraza did this deliberately, he thought. She has amplified me.
A feeling of awe threatened him. He recognized how his daughter, Odraid, had drawn upon such powers to create the Atreides Manifesto for Terraza. His own Mentat powers were submerged in that greater pattern. Terraza was demanding a fearful performance from him. The need for such a thing both challenged and terrified him. It could very well mean the end of the sisterhood.
The basic rule is this: never support weakness, always support strength.
The Bene Gesserit Coda.
How is it that you can order the priests around? Shiana asked. This is their place.
Odraid answered casually, but picked her words to fit the knowledge she knew Shiana already possessed.
The priests have Fremen roots. They've always had reverent mothers somewhere near. Besides, child, you order them around too.
That's different.
Odraid suppressed a smile. Little more than 3 hours had passed since her assault force had broken the attack on the temple complex. In that time, Odraid had set up a command center in Shiana's quarters, carried on the necessary business of assessment and preliminary retaliation, all the while prompting and observing Shiana. Simulflow. Odraid glanced around the room she had chosen as command center. A scrap of Styros's ripped garments still lay near the wall in front of her. Casualties. The room was an oddly shaped place, no two walls parallel. She sniffed. Still a residual smell of ozone from the snoopers with which her people had assured the privacy of these quarters. Why the odd shape? The building was ancient, remodeled and added to many times, but that did not explain this room. A pleasantly rough texture of creamy stucco on walls and ceiling. Elaborate spice-fiber hangings flanked the two doors. It was early evening, and sunlight filtered by lattice shades stippled the wall opposite the windows. Silver-yellow glow globes hovered near the ceiling, all tuned to match the sunlight. Muted street sounds came through the ventilators beneath the windows. The soft pattern of orange rugs and grey tiles on the floor spoke of wealth and security. But Odraid suddenly did not feel secure. A tall reverend mother came from the adjoining communications room.
Mother Commander, she said, the messages have been sent to Guild Ix and Leilaxu.
Odraid spoke absently.
Acknowledged.
The messenger returned to her duties.
What are you doing?
Shiana asked.
Studying something.
Odraid pursed her lips in thought. Their guides through the temple complex had brought them along a maze of hallways and stairs, glimpses of courtyards through arches, then into a splendid Ixian suspensor tube system which carried them silently to another hallway, more stairs, another curved hallway, finally into this room. Once more Odraid swept her gaze around the room.
"Why are you studying this room?" Shiana asked.
Hush, child.
The room was an irregular polyhedron, with a smaller side to the left. About 35 meters long, half that at the widest, many low divans and chairs in various degrees of comfort. Shiana sat in queenly splendour on a bright yellow chair with wide, soft arms. Not a chair dog in the place. Much brown and blue and yellow fabric. Odrade stared at the white lattice of a ventilator above a painting of mountains on the wider end wall. A cool breeze came through the ventilators below the windows and wafted toward the ventilator above the painting.
"This was Headless Room," Shiana said. "Why do you annoy him by using his first name, child?"
"Does that annoy him?"
"Don't play word games with me, child. You know it annoys him, and that's why you do it."
"Then why did you ask?"
Odrade ignored this, while continuing her careful study of the room. The wall opposite the painting stood at an oblique angle to the outer wall. She had it now. Clever. This room had been constructed so that even a whisper here could be heard by someone beyond the high ventilator. No doubt the painting concealed another airway to carry sounds from this room. No snooper, sniffer, or other instrument would detect such an arrangement. Nothing would beep at a spying eye or ear. Only the wary senses of someone trained in deception had winkled it out. A hand signal summoned a waiting acolyte. Odrade's fingers flickered in silent communication.
"Find out who is listening beyond that ventilator."
She nodded toward the ventilator above the painting.
"Let them continue. We must know to whom they report."
"How did you know to come and save me?"
Shiana asked. The child had a lovely voice, but it needed training, Odrade thought. There was a steadiness to it, though, that could be shaped into a powerful instrument.
"Answer me," Shiana ordered.
The imperious tone startled Odrade, arousing quick anger which she was forced to suppress. Corrections would have to be made immediately.
"Calm yourself, child," Odrade said.
She pitched the command in a precise tenor and saw it take effect. Again Shiana startled her.
"That's another kind of voice. You're trying to calm me. Kipuna told me all about voice."
Odrade turned squarely facing Shiana and looked down at her. Shiana's first grief had passed, but there was still anger when she spoke of Kipuna.
"I am busy shaping our response to that attack," Odrade said. "Why do you distract me? I should think you would want them punished."
"What will you do to them? Tell me, what will you do?"
A surprisingly vindictive child, Odrade thought. That would have to be curbed. Hatred was as dangerous an emotion as love. The capacity for hatred was the capacity for its opposite. Odrade said,
"I have sent Guild, Ix, and Tlaylaxu the message we